Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
From the studios at WMFE in Orlando, Florida, this is the Space Exploration Podcast that asks the question, are we there yet? Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. After launching from the Kennedy Space Center, flight controllers and directors in Houston, Texas, took over the operation of the Apollo missions, keeping a watchful eye on the crew and vehicle as it made the nearly 250,000-mile trip to the moon. One of those flight directors was Jerry Griffin. I spoke with Jerry about the role controllers played during the Apollo program and how the team handled the challenges and triumphs of the first moon missions, including the now famous SCE to AUX fix that saved Apollo 12.
Yeah, you know, 50 years ago, I was a lot younger, for one thing. But we were all young people, and the task we were doing had never been done. So we kind of had a blank sheet of paper. And we kind of had to figure out how we were going to do it. And I think mission control was a very unique situation because it had never been done, at least by the time we got in business. Yuri Gagarin had been in orbit when the Soviets put him up. So we had to learn kind of, it was on-the-job training pretty much throughout. And it was fun. The people in the control center were kind of wired to face challenges and deal with it and not get uptight. Mm-hmm. And so there was that feeling of camaraderie that kind of comes. It reminded me a little bit before I got to NASA, I was in the Air Force and I was in a fighter squadron. And the feeling in mission control had some of those same feelings to it. Mm-hmm. It was a team. A little bit cocky, but not arrogant about it, just confident. Uh-huh. And so it was a great time, and we had some, the astronauts were all good friends, and we worked closely with them, and it was a real team effort. And I think if there's a story to the legacy of Apollo, it was the teamwork. Uh-huh. And the feeling that we almost forgot the word pronoun I. We always used we, and we did something or we're going to do something because we knew it was a... And then one more point on that, mission control and the astronauts got most of the coverage because we were there the longest with all of the flight activities that went on, but we had this huge pyramid of support below us that we couldn't have done the job without them. And it involved other NASA centers. It involved the contractors that built the hardware. They were all at the ready the entire time we were in flight. If we needed a test run at Rockwell on the West Coast or at Grumman on the East Coast, if we needed a test run to check something out, they were there for us. And so it was a huge team effort, not just a team effort. It was a huge team, and it paid off.
Walk me through a typical day for you there. What were the sights, the sounds, the smells of mission control, and what was your job?
Well, as a flight director, you are it's like a little bit like a symphony conductor. You're in charge of the final product, which was generally a go or a no-go for every step along the way. But you didn't play any of the instruments anymore. You had to know every position and what they were doing and then put it all together and come with a decision. We worked in teams because we had to work around the clock. So we had, a flight director had a team of flight controllers that were under him. And, in those days it was all him. Now in space station we have, women flight directors, thank goodness. And but in those days, our teams, we had six teams that got us through all of Apollo. I was one of the six flight directors that led a team. We had colors for our team, by the way.
Mosher's?
Gold. I was gold team. We had white, black, green, maroon, and orange, and gold. That was the six. So it was, sometimes if your shift might start at 1 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes it might start at 8 in the morning, like a regular job. But it, once we got into flight, it felt nonstop to me the whole time. When things were quiet, we could get a little sleep, go home and get a little sleep. We only lived about a half mile from the center, so I could get home pretty fast. But we all had little kids, too. And so the sleep was kind of few and far between. We did have a room, by the way, where we could go, and they had bunks if you wanted to try to sleep there. And I did that a few times. No windows. Turn the air conditioner down to stun, and you could sleep pretty well. And so it was around the clock. It was a little bit, there's an old adage in the fighter pilot business that, what was it like? Somebody asked and said, well, hours and hours of boredom interrupted by a few moments of stark terror. And the space business had a little bit of that to it, because invariably, every flight had some issue. Now, some were more serious than others, but we had to deal sometimes with things we had specifically trained for, that kind of failure, and then like Apollo 13, where the oxygen tank exploded, we had to just kind of make up what we were going to try to do to get them back. Mm-hmm. And everything in between, all kinds of little things that were nagging, and then severe things like the lightning, for instance, too, on Apollo 12, that hit us here at the Cape as we were lifting off.
Yeah, you've been involved in quite a few high-stress, challenging decisions, like the Apollo 12 lightning strike, Apollo 13, helping getting that crew home. Walk me through what it's like when that lightning strike happened. What first went through your mind when you knew there was a problem?
Well, Apollo 12 was particularly exciting for me. It was my first launch as a flight director, where I was in charge. I'd been on launches, but the first time I was the flight director for it. My first thought, because what we said, we didn't know what happened in mission control, and neither did the crew initially, but our data froze when the lightning hit. It froze our data, so we had no information. The crew, the lights dimmed in the cockpit, and then Pete had a caution and warning panel that just lit up like a Christmas tree, and he started reading those off to us. And my first thought was, and this took about a millisecond, but here's my first time as a launch flight director, and I'm probably going to have to abort. But thank goodness the Saturn V was in control. It had its own computer. The command module computer was the backup for the launch. We could switch to it if we had to, but it was completely down. It was kaput. Everything was off. But thank goodness the Saturn V was right on target. And I'd looked. We had a big plot board that I could see the ascent trajectory, and we were right on it. So I remembered, and again, this maybe was in the second. If we're going to have to abort, don't do it now. Gain some altitude and make sure the parachutes have plenty of altitude to deploy correctly and get them down in the water. Well, we kept going, and then a young man named John Aaron, I think he was 25 maybe, 20, he could have been 26, and made the call that I think saved the mission. He said, tell him to try SCE to AUX. And it was such an obscure switch that none of us had ever talked about it. And I remember I said, what? And he said, tell him to try SCE to AUX. So I told Jerry Carr, who was the CAPCOM, I said, SCE to AUX. And Jerry said, what? And so I repeated it. And about that time, John Aaron came back in and said, SCE to auxiliary. So Jerry read up to the crew, SCE to auxiliary. And Pete Conrad said, what the hell is that? And that was his actual answer. He said, "What the hell is that?" Well, Al Bean knew where it was. And he threw the switch, and when he did, we got all of our data back in the control center. SCE was signal conditioning equipment. It had to do with the data shaping before it was telemetered down to the ground. And when we went to the auxiliary unit, it was okay. It must have fried the first one, the lightning did. So as soon as he got data back, same guy, John Aaron, could see that the fuel cells that produce power had been knocked off the circuitry. They were disconnected. So he said, tell him to reset the fuel cells. Well, he reset the fuel cells. Power came back on in the spacecraft. We had all our data, and we, at this point, I was dead determined we're going to go to orbit because it's a lot easier to get down from there if we have to come down without having to board off of a rocket.
And we got to remind our listeners, this is all happening as the Saturn V is barreling into space, right?
Yeah, it's still going like a rocket, and sure enough, we got into orbit right on the money, and we said, well, now can we go to the moon or not? And that was probably the tougher call that I had to make eventually with a lot of help. But it was, shall we go on to the moon? And we checked things out. We checked the engine in the back to make sure all of it controlled right and so forth, and it did. And we couldn't find anything wrong. We said, well, let's go to the moon. And so I remember how satisfying that was, say, let's go for the moon. And the interesting thing is that we did translunar injection, headed out to the moon, and that turned out to be the cleanest mission from that point on that we had in the program. We had almost nothing go wrong after that. And so it's a good call, and we made it. I had to give the final go, no go, but it was a team effort to get that thing. And it showed what people could do, you know, when put under pressure. And, you know, the funny thing about it, the room was calm. There was no gnashing of teeth and wringing of hands. It we stepped right through it and said, let's go.
What's the moment in the Apollo 12 mission where you breathe a sigh of relief?
When we did the translunar injection maneuver, that's what was restarting the third stage of the Saturn to add some velocity to push us to the moon. When that engine cut off, I felt we're going to make it. And, of course, they still had to separate the command module, plug it into the lunar module, and extract it from that third stage. But we had done that before, and it seemed to work. And I was pretty comfortable after that. Mm-hmm. And Conrad, Pete Conrad, the commander, they kind of got the giggles. It's like having a near accident in an automobile, you know, and everybody says, oh, boy, that was... And you could tell, we didn't hear them real time, but when we dumped the voice tape of just what they were saying on board, it was extremely funny. They were laughing. He said, good God, I didn't know what the heck was going on there. And Dick Gordon said the same thing. And so did Al Bean, and they were laughing about it. But after that, they flew a good mission. They really, and it shows what preparation can do.
That was my next question: is how do you prepare for those moments of chaos and maintaining clarity through chaos and the unknown?
Well, I think the reason Apollo, well, and all the space missions have been successful is because of the training, and by that I mean the simulation. 50 years ago, even, we had simulation capability. Today, when I look back, it astounds me that it was good as it was. Very high fidelity. The astronauts were in one building in a simulator that looked a lot like a command module. We were in mission control. The two buildings were wired together. And in mission control, it looked just like a real flight to us. And in between the two of us was a simulation group. The call sign was SimSoup, Simulation Supervisor. And he was diabolical. He could throw in failures and see how we handled it. And he would throw us one, and we'd handle it. He'd throw us another one, we'd handle it. Then he'd throw us two at the same time. And most of the time we could handle that. And then he would get really far out to see how far we could go. We did something called mission rules. We tried to pre-think every failure we could think of, and what would we do in that failure? And the SIM guys were really good at finding holes in our mission rules, and they would go find one.
Well, it was their job, right?
Yeah, that's right. And we would do something, and they'd say, "You didn't do what the mission rules say. Why didn't you?" Or you did something that the mission rules said you shouldn't do. And so it would really get us thinking about that particular kind of failure again. We'd go back and redo the mission rules again. Well, anyway, by the time you got through the simulations, for instance, when one day we might simulate 10 Saturn launches, some we would abort, some in the simulation, some we would go on into orbit and do the right thing. What it really came down to at the end of the day, most of the flights were easier than the simulations. It was a little bit like running on a beach with combat boots on and then taking them off. And gee whiz, it was a lot easier. Well, the missions themselves, for the most part, except maybe 13, it was easier than the simulation. So that training was absolutely essential, and I think it's the reason that we were able to get 6 landings done and get them all home and didn't leave anybody up there in the process. We were ready. We were prepared for it.
Jerry Griffin, 50 years on, what's your outlook on human exploration now and, you know, the goals of putting humans back on the moon and to go to places like Mars? Is this where you thought we'd be 50 years out?
Well, 50 years ago, I thought by now we would probably already be to Mars, but we haven't. And to put the whole thing in context, I'd start here on the Earth. I think the commercial sector has been very important for the future, and it hasn't shown itself as much yet, maybe as it will, but I'm sorry it took so long to get the commercial guys really cranked up and interested in seeing the potential in it. Because I think in the long run, what that's going to do is put NASA in a position more of real exploration, not just going to and from Earth orbit. Now, going to and from Earth orbit is not easy either, but it's a lot simpler than going on to the moon and then to Mars. I believe long term, I believe the domain of low Earth orbit is going to belong to the commercial sector. And NASA and its international partners will focus on real exploration. I think we must go back to the moon first. And the reason I say that is it's been 50 years since we've been out there, and it's different. It's different than flying in low Earth orbit. And I really think we need get our mojo, our momentum back on operating in deep space. It's different in a lot of ways. In Earth orbit, you can get guys home in a couple, 3 hours if you have to. Uh-huh. At the moon, the quickest you're going to do is about 3 days. So when you have a problem that is particularly one that's life-threatening, then you've got your hands full at the moon. At Mars, it's even worse. Even the comm delay at the moon was only about a second and a half, and part of that was due to some switching points that we had in the system, but about a second of it almost even that was confusing until we got used to it because we tended to talk over each other. And at Mars, that could be 16, 20 minutes in that range. So that tells you got to do things differently. So I think we need a step-by-step approach here, and I think going to the moon first and on to Mars then. And then, by the way, I think Mars is still a tiny step. I think, and I won't see it in my lifetime, but I hope it gets done pretty quickly. And thank goodness for the commercial sector. It's not easy. They're finding that out now. There's problems. You have explosions and trying to figure out how you're going to do all this, and they're finding that out. But I think they're good. They know what they're doing. And after all, contractors built everything we've flown on. NASA never built a human spaceflight rocket and put somebody on it. That was done by our contract workforce. So I'm just glad to see the commercial guys step up and kind of try to take over this low Earth orbit.
And you've had a chance to spend some time with some students that are here. Is the outlook bright for the next generation of rocket scientists?
I don't think there's any doubt that the future is very bright for the future. The kids, and particularly these kids here at the Conrad Challenge, are just phenomenal. But I see it all over the country, too. The STEM education effort is paying off. There's just a lot of kids around the country now that are really interested, men and women, and kids of all kinds. And that's great. It's really great. They're going to be smarter and more ready than we were. When I got to NASA, I had figured out on my own what an orbit was, because when I graduated from college, there was no aerospace curriculum. There was no flight dynamics taught, trajectories and all that. The systems were kind of similar in terms of the things you had to do to survive and breathe and have power and all that. But it just didn't exist. So we had to kind of learn it from the ground up. And these kids, I can listen to them talk now, and they're farther along than I was at the end of Apollo. So I think this bunch is going to be here's what we need, though, is we need the ones that like that challenge and the passion to go make it happen. As far as I know, I don't think anybody was ever fired out of Mission Control. We had a few that self-eliminated themselves because they didn't like the pressure. But most of the people in Mission Control, and this I think is true today, they like that feeling of being on the end of the diving board with nobody else around, and they have to make the decision whether to jump or not. And I really think that's what we've got to make sure that the kids that are coming along now that are going to be very important to go back into deep space particularly, have got that preparation and that willingness to take on the challenge and kind of have it in their DNA that it doesn't frighten them. And that's the difference. It's when you're facing life and death decisions that count on you, it's can you do it in a measured way? And not overreact and get all panicky. And I'll tell you a quick story. I worked as technical advisor on Apollo 13 for the movie. And I never could get Ron Howard to do this right, but he always wanted movement in the scene. And so they actually had extra stage behind the camera shot to have people walking back and forth in the control center. And I kept telling Ron, that's not accurate. The room was calm. It was a calm place to be. And he said, yeah, but he said, I can't just have static people talking and all that. So he had to have these things in the background. But I never could convince him that the real world was that there was not that kind of motion. In fact, we fought against any kind of noise or motion. Just do your work. Look at your data. Talk on the loop. Don't talk ear to ear to each other, and so we all hear what everybody's thinking. And but anyway, it was kind of funny. I ran into it, and never could convince him that just keep it calm. I told him when I had just gotten off shift, and my team had left right before the tank exploded on Apollo 13. And we handed off to Gene Kranz's white team, and I went out to play a ball game, a softball game, and they came out and got us. And when I went back into the control center, I was still in my sweats and had a baseball hat on, and I walked back in there. I had my badge, of course, to get in, and there were some stern faces, but the room was very calm, and I'd probably gotten there. I was probably there 30 minutes after the tank exploded, and there were some serious looks, but there was no chaos, and there wasn't a bunch of people running around with their, with their heads cut off. It was actually surprising to me, as calm as it was, and I stuck around for a while. I said, I better go get some sleep because I'm going to have to come back in here, and I went home, couldn't sleep much, and finally got up and took a shower and came back in, but the room was, that whole situation was, you could tell was a bunch of people that were prepared, and that's what these young people that we are seeing here, they're going to step right into that.
Jerry Griffin, this was incredible to speak with you. Thanks for your insight and reminiscing with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's fun to tell a story. Even 50 years later.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode. The conversation continues online. You can follow us on Facebook, search for Are We There Yet Podcast, or send us a tweet. We're at AWTY Mars. Are We There Yet Mars? Get it. Or if you have a story idea or guest pitch, you can send me an email. We're at arewethereyet@wmfe.org. This podcast is a production of WMFE, and our theme music was composed by Kevin McLeod. More Apollo stories are online at wmfe.org/Apollo. Until next time, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.